treatment is complete, hoping they will absorb enough intellectual nutrients to maintain their vital signs until they have graduated and paid their tuition in full. That caricature highlights a truth. Our assumption that students are brain dead leads to pedagogies that deaden their brains. When we teach by dripping information into their passive forms, students who arrive in the classroom alive and well become passive consumers of knowledge and are dead on departure when they graduate. But the power of this self-fulfilling prophecy seems to elude us. We rarely consider that our students may die in the classroom because we use methods that assume they are dead. I once led a faculty workshop where the conversation had turned toward students, and many participants were complaining about how silent and indifferent they are. The workshop was being held in a glass-walled conference room at the core of a new classroom building, and the curtains that might have shut off our view of the surrounding hallways had been left open. In the midst of the student bashing, a bell rang, and the classrooms surrounding the conference room began to empty out. The halls quickly filled with young people talking to each other with great energy and animation. I asked the faculty to observe the evidence before us, and then asked them to explain the difference between the students they had been describing and the ones we were now seeing. Is it possible that your students are not brain dead? Is it possible that their classroom coma is induced by classroom conditions, and that once they cross the threshold into another world, they return to life? We need a new diagnosis of our students' inward condition, one that is more perceptive about their needs, less defensive about our own role in their plight, and more likely to lead to creative modes of teaching. I want to suggest such a diagnosis by telling another teaching story from my own experience. I had just finished a 2-day faculty workshop on a Midwestern university campus. Amid high praise for the work we had done together, which I was told had given people deeper insight into the pedagogical arts, I was ushered into a political science class where I had agreed to be teacher for an hour. I should have left while the leaving was good. There were 30 students in that classroom. It is possible that 29 of them were ready to learn, but I will never know. For in the back row, in the far corner, slouched the specter called the student from hell. The student from hell is a universal archetype that can take male or female form. Mine happened to be male. His cap was pulled down over his eyes so that I could not tell whether they were open or shut. His notebooks and writing instruments were nowhere to be seen. It was a fine spring day, but his jacket was buttoned tight, signifying readiness to bolt at any moment. What I remember most vividly is his posture. Though he sat in one of those sadistic classroom chairs with a rigidly attached desk, he had achieved a position that I know to be anatomically impossible. Despite the interposed desk, his body was parallel to the floor. Seeking desperately to find even one redeeming feature in the specter before me, I seized on the idea that he must practice the discipline of Hatha Yoga to be able to distort his body so completely. At that point in my life, I had been teaching for 25 years. Yet faced with the student from hell, I committed the most basic mistake of the greenest neophyte. I became totally obsessed with him, and everyone else in the room disappeared from my screen. For a long and anguished hour, I aimed everything I had at this young man, trying desperately to awaken him from his dogmatic slumbers. But the harder I tried, the more he seemed to recede. Meanwhile, the other students became ciphers as my obsession with the student from hell made me oblivious to their needs. I learned that day what a black hole is, a place where the gravity is so intense that all traces of light disappear. I left that class with a powerful combination of feelings, self-pity, fraudulence, and rage. On the heels of a highly touted workshop on teaching, I had put on a stunningly inept demonstration of the art. The regular teacher had taken my presence as an excuse to skip his own class, so my travesty had gone unobserved by any peer, as usual. But my self-respect was gravely wounded, and I knew whom to blame. It was the fault of the student from hell. Self-pity and projected blame, the recipe for a well-lived life. I was desperate to get out of town, but I had to suffer through one more event, dinner with a few faculty at the president's house. There the workshop received fresh praise, But now the praise was painful, driving me deeper into feelings of fraudulence. When the president announced the arrival of the college van that would haul me to the airport, I was flooded with relief. I went out to the driveway, tossed my bags into the back seat of the van, climbed into the front seat, and turned to greet the driver. It was the student from hell. I am a religious person, so I commenced to pray. I have sinned, I do sin, and given attractive opportunity, I will probably sin again. But nothing I have ever done or plan to do merits this punishment, an hour and a half in a van with a student from hell. We backed out of the driveway and wound our way through the neighborhood, staring ahead in silence. When we reached the freeway, the driver suddenly spoke. "Dr. Palmer, is it okay if we talk?" Every atom in my body screamed, "No!" But my mouth, which was trained in the suburbs, said, "Sure, fine, yes, you bet." I will always remember the conversation that followed. The student's father was an unemployed laborer and an alcoholic who thought that his son's desire to finish college and become some sort of professional was utter nonsense. The young man lived with his father, who berated him daily for his foolishness. "The world is out to get people like us, and college is part of the scam. Drop out, get a fast food job, save whatever you can and settle for it. That's how it's always been, and that's how it'll always be." Daily, this young man felt his motivation for college fading away. "Have you ever been in a situation like this?" he asked. "What do you think I should do about it?" We talked until it was time for my plane to take off, and for a while afterward we corresponded. I do not know whether I helped him, but I know that he helped me. He helped me understand that the silent and seemingly sullen students in our classrooms are not brain dead. They are full of fear. The student from hell is not born that way, but is created by conditions beyond his or her control. Yes, one or two of them may have been sent here directly by Satan to destroy Western civilization as we know and love it. But this particular student, whose plight represents many others, forced me into a deeper understanding of the student condition, one that is slowly transforming the way I teach. Students are marginalized people in our society. The silence that we face in the classroom is the silence that has always been adopted by people on the margin, people who have reason to fear those in power and have learned that there is safety in not speaking. For years, African Americans were silent in the presence of whites, silent, that is, about their true thoughts and feelings. For years, women were similarly silent in the presence of men. Today, all of that is changing as blacks and women move from the margins to the center and speak truths that people like me need to hear. But young people remain marginalized in our society, and their plight has worsened since the 1960s as we have become more and more fearful and dismissive of our youth. Implicitly and explicitly, young people are told that they have no experience worth having, no voice worth speaking, no future of any note, no significant role to play. Is it any wonder that students, having received such messages from a dozen sources, stay silent in the classroom rather than risk another dismissal or rebuke? Their silence is born not of stupidity or banality, but of a desire to protect themselves and to survive. It is a silence driven by their fear of an adult world in which they feel alien and disempowered. Of course, some of our students are not young in years. Some have returned to school in midlife and may even be older than their teachers. But the fear in our younger students has its counterpart in our older students as well. Non-traditional students often return to school because of an experience that puts them too on the margins, a divorce, the failure of a career, the death of a spouse. We think of them as more expressive and self-confident than their younger peers. But perhaps their years have merely given them more practice at keeping their fears tucked away. Inwardly, these students relate to teachers as elders, even if the age difference is reversed, and they may easily be as apprehensive about how we will respond to them as younger students tend to be. If I want to teach well in the face of my students' fears, I need to see clearly and steadily the fear that is in their hearts. No technique could have altered my classroom debacle with a student from hell, because the trouble began in a more inward, less tractable place, in my failure to read him and his behavior perceptively. I read that student not in the light of his condition, but in the shadow of my own, a point to which I will return shortly, and my self-absorbed misreading led me into one of my lowest moments in teaching. The behaviors generated by fear, silence, withdrawal, cynicism, often mimic those that come with ignorance, so it is not always easy for me to keep believing when I look at some of my students that anxiety rather than banality is what I am looking at. I need to keep renewing my insight into my students' true condition in spite of misleading appearances. It is not easy, but it is rewarding. As I have come to understand my students' fears, I have been able to aim my teaching in a new direction. I no longer teach to their imputed ignorance, having rejected that assessment as both inaccurate and self-serving. Instead, I try to teach to their fearful hearts, and when I am able to do so, their minds often come along as well. I now understand what Nell Morton meant when she said that one of the greatest tasks in our time is to hear people to speech. Behind their fearful silence, our students want to find their voices, speak their voices, have their voices heard. A good teacher is one who can listen to those voices even before they are spoken, so that someday they can speak with truth and confidence. What does it mean to listen to a voice before it is spoken? It means making space for the other, being aware of the other, paying attention to the other, honoring the other. It means not rushing to fill our students' silences with fearful speech of our own and not trying to coerce them into saying the things that we want to hear. It means entering empathetically into the student's world so that he or she perceives you as someone who has the promise of being able to hear another person's truth. In the story of the student from hell, there is a powerful image that offers a clue about how to hear students into speech. That young man found his voice when he was literally behind the wheel. Sitting passively in the classroom while I held forth, he was reduced to silence. But given a real responsibility, put in charge of my schedule and my safety, he found a voice to speak of significant things. As I find ways to put my students behind the wheel, I will encourage more and more of them to find their voices and speak for themselves. There are methods that can help me do this, and I will explore some of them later in this book. But before I can use those methods with integrity and with effectiveness, I must understand the fear within my students' hearts, and the fear that is in my own. The teacher's fearful heart. Why do we have so much trouble seeing students as they really are? Why do we diagnose their condition in morbid terms that lead to deadly modes of teaching? Why do we not see the fear that is in their hearts and find ways to help them through it rather than accusing them of being ignorant and banal? On one level, the answer is simple. Our conventional diagnosis allows us to ignore our failings as teachers by blaming the victims. But there is a deeper reason for our blindness to our students' fears, and it is more daunting. We cannot see the fear in our students until we see the fear in ourselves. When we deny our own condition, we resist seeing anything in others that might remind us of who and how we really are. If you were reading between the lines in my story of the student from hell, you know that there are two morals to that tale. One is about the fear in the student, the other is about the fear within me. Looked at objectively, it is hard to believe that I was afraid of that young man, thus demonstrating the limits of objectivity. There I was at a small university in the Midwest from which I would soon take leave, having gained the approval of the people who had hired me, on whom my livelihood depends. There I was in my early 50s, career in full flight, doing work I find rich in meaning, blessed with health and family and friends. There I was, face to face with a forlorn young man in his early 20s who had no apparent power over me, and I was so afraid of him that I lost my bearings, my capacity to teach, my sense of self and self-worth. In unguarded moments with close friends, we who teach will acknowledge a variety of fears. Having our work go unappreciated, being inadequately rewarded, discovering one fine morning that we chose the wrong profession, spending our lives on trivia, ending up feeling like frauds. But many of us have another fear that we rarely name, our fear of the judgment of the young. Day after day, year after year, we walk into classrooms and look into younger faces that seem to signal, in ways crude and subtle, your history, whatever you value, we don't. And since you couldn't possibly understand the things we value, we won't even bother to try to tell you what they are. We are here only because we are forced to be here. So whatever you have to do, get it over with and let us get on with our lives. That is how we sometimes interpret the signals that our students send, when, in truth, they are usually signals of fear, not disdain. Until I learn to decode that message, I will be quick to cast too many of my students in the role of the student from hell, and I will never learn to decode it until I understand my own fear of the judgment of the young. Erik Erikson, reflecting on adult development, says that in midlife we face a choice between stagnation and generativity. Erikson's notion can be useful even if you are a young teacher, once you understand that teachers age at a geometric rate. My best guess is that most teachers reach midlife by the time they turn 29. When one returns to work each fall and finds one's students the same age they were last year, middle age comes long before its time. Stagnation is the state chosen by teachers who are so threatened by students that they barricade themselves behind their credentials, their podiums, their status, their research. Ironically, this choice for stagnation mirrors the disengagement of the students these teachers fear. Having been wounded by fearful young people who hold their teachers at arm's length, these teachers fearfully fend off their students, thus feeding the cycle of fear. It is not unusual to see faculty in mid-career don the armor of cynicism against students, education, and any sign of hope. It is the cynicism that comes when the high hopes one once had for teaching have been dashed by experience, or by the failure to interpret one's experience accurately. I am always impressed by the intensity of this cynicism, for behind it I feel the intensity of the hopes that brought these faculty into teaching. Perhaps those hopes can be rekindled, because the intensity is still there. Rightly understood, this sort of cynicism may contain the seeds of its own renewal. The way of renewal, according to Erik Erikson, is called generativity. It is a lovely and exact word because it suggests two related dimensions of a healthy adult identity. On one hand, it suggests creativity, the ongoing possibility that no matter our age, we can help co-create the world. On the other hand, it suggests the endless emergence of the generations, with its implied imperative that the elders look back toward the young and help them find a future that the elders will not see. Put these two images together, and generativity becomes creativity in the service of the young, a way in which the elders serve not only the young, but also their own well-being. In the face of the apparent judgment of the young, teachers must turn toward students, not away from them, saying, in effect, there are great gaps between us, but no matter how wide and perilous they may be, I am committed to bridging them, not only because you need me to help you on your way, but also because I need your insight and energy to help me renew my own life. I have thought a great deal about my fear of the student from hell, and it seems to have two parts. One of them I hope to lose someday, but the other I hope always to have with me. The fear I want to get rid of is rooted in my need to be popular with young people, a need that may be endemic among people who become teachers, but one that keeps us from serving our students well. This fear is pathological. It leads me to pander to students, to lose both my dignity and my way, so worried that the sloucher in the back row doesn't like me that I fail to teach him and everyone else in the room. But I hope never to lose the other part of my fear, the fear I feel when I am not in life-giving communion with the young. I hope never to encounter an alienated student sitting in the back row of a class and act as if he or she did not exist. When the student from hell ceases to be relevant to me, my life becomes less relevant to the world. Reflecting on my experience with the student from hell, I reproach myself for having failed to teach well that day. But it is also true that something that I did in that classroom made it possible for that young man to approach me a few hours later about one of the deepest dilemmas of his life. Something I did helped draw that young man into a relationship where he was able to speak his truth. Perhaps what reached him, despite my fear and my ineptitude, was my yearning for a generative relationship, my yearning not to be cut off. It is easier to forgive myself for failing the rest of those students when I name what may well be true, that my passion to connect with one student somehow got through to him and eventually empowered him to speak. When he spoke, he addressed not only his own need, but my need as well, my need to stay connected with the life of the rising generation. Good teaching is an act of hospitality toward the young, and hospitality is always an act that benefits the host even more than the guest. The concept of hospitality arose in ancient times when this reciprocity was easier to see. In nomadic cultures, the food and shelter one gave to a stranger yesterday is the food and shelter one hopes to receive from a stranger tomorrow. By offering hospitality, one participates in the endless reweaving of a social fabric on which all can depend. Thus, the gift of sustenance for the guest becomes a gift of hope for the host. It is that way in teaching as well. The teacher's hospitality to the student results in a world more hospitable to the teacher. One of the blessings of teaching is the chance it gives us for continuing encounters with the young. But whatever eventually blesses us may at first feel like a curse. We are more likely to survive the curse and arrive at the blessing if we understand that we may be as afraid of our students as they are of us, and then learn to decode our own fears as well as theirs for the sake of creativity in the service of the young. Our fearful way of knowing. The personal fears that students and teachers bring to the classroom are fed by the fact that the roots of education are sunk deep in fearful ground. The ground I have in mind is one we rarely name. It is our dominant mode of knowing, a mode promoted with such arrogance that it is hard to see the fear behind it, until one remembers that arrogance often masks fear. A mode of knowing arises from the way we answer two questions at the heart of the educational mission. How do we know what we know? And by what warrant can we call our knowledge true? Our answers may be largely tacit, even unconscious, but they are continually communicated in the way we teach and learn. If we regard truth as something handed down from authorities on high, the classroom will look like a dictatorship. If we regard truth as fiction determined by personal whim, the classroom will look like anarchy. If we regard truth as emerging from a complex process of mutual inquiry, the classroom will look like a resourceful and interdependent community. Our assumptions about knowing can open up or shut down the capacity for connectedness on which good teaching depends. The mode of knowing that dominates education creates disconnections between teachers, their subjects, and their students because it is rooted in fear. This mode, called objectivism, portrays truth as something we can achieve only by disconnecting ourselves physically and emotionally from the thing we want to know. Why? Because if we get too close to it, the impure contents of our subjective lives will contaminate that thing and our knowledge of it. No matter what it is, an episode in history, a creature from the wild, a passage in great literature, or a phenomenon of human behavior, objectivism claims that we can know the things of the world truly and well only from afar. For objectivism, the subjective self is the enemy most to be feared, a Pandora's box of opinion, bias, and ignorance that will distort our knowledge once the lid flies open. We keep the lid shut by relying exclusively on reason and facts, logic and data that cannot be swayed by subjective desire, or so the theory goes. The role of the mind and the senses in this scheme is not to connect us to the world, but to hold the world at bay, lest our knowledge of it be tainted. In objectivism, subjectivity is feared not only because it contaminates things, but because it creates relationships between those things and us. And relationships are contaminating as well. When a thing ceases to be an object and becomes a vital, interactive part of our lives, whether it is a work of art, an indigenous people, or an ecosystem, it might get a grip on us, biasing us toward it, thus threatening the purity of our knowledge once again. So objectivism, driven by fear, keeps us from forging relationships with the things of the world. Its modus operandi is simple. When we distance ourselves from something, it becomes an object. When it becomes an object, it no longer has life. When it is lifeless, it cannot touch or transform us, so our knowledge of the thing remains pure. For objectivism, any way of knowing that requires subjective involvement between the knower and the known is regarded as primitive, unreliable, and even dangerous. The intuitive is regarded as irrational. True feeling is dismissed as sentimental. The imagination is seen as chaotic and unruly. And storytelling is labeled as personal and pointless. That is why music, art, and dance are at the bottom of the academic pecking order, and the hard sciences are at the top. That is why every soft discipline in the curriculum has practitioners doing research that is more objective than thou. Literary scholars who count adverbs rather than explore meanings. Psychologists who analyze the data of human behavior as if people had no more inner life than styrofoam. Years ago, Alfred North Whitehead declared that inert ideas were the bane of higher education, deadening the process of teaching and learning for students and teachers alike. But for objectivism, the only good idea is an inert idea that, like the Lepidopterist's prize butterfly, is no longer elusive and on the wing, but has been chloroformed, pinned, boxed, and labeled. This way of knowing may render the world lifeless, but that, say its proponents, is a small price to pay for what they call objective truth. I have not forgotten that objectivism originated in part to save us from the evils of reckless subjectivity. The victims of the Black Death would have benefited from the objective knowledge that their suffering was caused by fleas from infected rats, not by offenses against God. The countless women burned at the stake because someone called them witches bear mute testimony to the cruelties that subjectivity can breed. Objectivism set out to put truth on firmer ground than the whims of princes and priests, and for that we can be grateful. But history is full of ironies, and one of them is the way objectivism has bred new versions of the same evils it tried to correct. Two examples come quickly to mind: the rise of modern dictatorships and the character of contemporary warfare. A good case can be made that objectivism, which intended to free people from the clutches of arbitrary power, has sometimes conspired with other forces to deliver modern people into the clutches of totalitarianism. As people became convinced that objective answers to all questions were possible, and as specialists emerged who were glad to give those answers, people began to distrust their own knowledge and turn to authorities for truth. Thus the stage was set for authorities with a political agenda to seize power at moments of social vulnerability, proclaiming, "I alone know the truth that will save you. Fall in and follow me." The cruelties of modern warfare are another outcome of objectivity run amok, just as the cruelties of the witch hunt were the consequence of subjectivity gone mad. Many Americans found the Gulf War acceptable, even popular, because it was fought with a technology that allows us to do violence to others at distances that keep us safe. We killed tens of thousands of Iraqis in the Gulf War, but all we saw were shadowy images of destruction, images that were applauded in TV rooms throughout the land. So grateful are we for the capacity to kill at great remove. Contrast this with the war in Vietnam, which we were forced to fight up close, subjectively. A war considerably less popular with the American people than the objectivist war in the Persian Gulf. In Vietnam, our soldiers came face to face with the enemy. Our civilians came face to face with the deaths of 50,000 Americans, and we sank into a national slough of guilt and grief. When President Bush declared that our victory in the Persian Gulf had finally allowed us to kick the Vietnam syndrome, he was celebrating the triumph of objective detachment over subjective intimacy. Why does objectivism conspire with totalitarianism and violence? From the outset, the objectivist impulse was more than a quest for truth. It was a fear-driven overkill of the subjectivity that made the pre-modern world dangerous. Objectivism was never content to quarantine subjectivity in order to stop its spread. It aimed at killing the germ of self to secure objective truth, just as dictators kill dissenters to secure the public order, and warriors kill the enemy to secure the peace. Killing the self is not an image of my invention. It can be found at the heart of the objectivist literature itself. A century ago, when objectivism was in full flower, the philosopher Carl Pearson wrote an influential book called The Grammar of Science, in which he made a classic case for objective knowledge, arguing that the habit of forming a judgment upon facts unbiased by personal feeling is characteristic of what may be termed the scientific frame of mind. Unfortunately, Pearson accompanied his classic case with a classic Freudian slip. The scientific man has, above all things, to strive at self-elimination in his judgments. Some may call it ambiguous diction, but I call it prophecy. In the century since Pearson wrote, objectivism has pursued its goal of eliminating the self with considerable success when a student must ask if he can use I in an autobiography. My case against objectivism has been normative to this point. Objectivism, fearful of both the knowing self and the thing known, distances self from world and deforms our relationships with our subjects, our students, and ourselves. But an even more telling case can be made against this mode of knowing. It fails to give a faithful account of how knowing actually happens, even at the heart of science itself. No scientist knows the world merely by holding it at arm's length. If we ever managed to build the objectivist wall between the knower and the known, we could know nothing except the wall itself. Science requires an engagement with the world, a live encounter between the knower and the known. That encounter has moments of distance, but it would not be an encounter without moments of intimacy as well. Knowing of any sort is relational, animated by a desire to come into deeper community with what we know. Why does a historian study the dead past? To reveal how much of it lives in us today. Why does a biologist study the mute world of nature? To allow us to hear its voice speaking of how entwined we are in life's ecology. Why does a literary scholar study the world of fiction? To show us that facts can never be understood except in communion with the imagination. Knowing is how we make community with the unavailable other, with realities that would elude us without the connective tissue of knowledge. Knowing is a human way to seek relationship and in the process to have encounters and exchanges that will inevitably alter us. At its deepest reaches, knowing is always communal. The now famous story of biologist Barbara McClintock illumines the fact that we know by connecting with the world, not by disconnecting from it. McClintock, who died in 1992 at age 90, became fascinated early in her career with the mysteries of genetic transposition. Though her research was often dismissed as wildly unorthodox, she pursued it into discoveries that changed the map of modern genetics, and she was honored in 1983 with a Nobel Prize. McClintock did not objectify her subject, did not approach it with the textbook notion that her task was to analyze it into data bits. Instead, she approached genetic material on the assumption that it could best be understood as a communal phenomenon. As one writer has said, McClintock made a crucial discovery by recognizing that the genetics of living organisms is more complex and interdependent than anyone had believed. By observing how genes function in their environment, rather than regarding them merely as isolated entities, she discovered that bits of genes can move about on chromosomes. when Evelyn Fox Keller interviewed McClintock in order to write her biography, it became clear that the communal premise of McClintock's work went well beyond the relationship among genes. It included the relationship between the genes and the scientist who studied them. Keller wanted to know what enabled McClintock to see further and deeper into the mysteries of genetics than her colleagues. McClintock's answer, Keller tells us, is simple. Over and over again, she tells us one must have the time to look, the patience to hear what the material has to say to you, the openness to let it come to you. Above all, one must have a feeling for the organism. Of course, McClintock's science was distinguished by precise analytical thinking and impeccable data. One does not win a Nobel Prize without them. But data and logic, and the distance they provide, are only one pole of the paradox of great science. When McClintock, arguably the greatest biologist of our century, is asked to name the heart of her knowing, she invariably uses the language of relationship, of connectedness, of community. As one commentator puts it, McClintock gained valuable knowledge by empathizing with her corn plants, submerging herself in their world, and dissolving the boundary between object and observer. Keller sums up McClintock's genius and the genius of all great knowing in a single, luminous sentence. McClintock, in her relation to ears of corn, achieved the highest form of love, love that allows for intimacy without the annihilation of difference. These remarkable words describe not only the heart of Barbara McClintock's science, but also the heart of every authentic relationship that a human being might have, with history, with nature, with other people, with things of the spirit. They describe a way of knowing and of living that has moved beyond fear of the other into respect for, even a need for, its otherness. The real agenda driving objectivism is not to tell the truth about knowing, but to shore up our self-aggrandizing myth that knowledge is power and that with it we can run the world. People often lie in an effort to deny their fears, and objectivism lies about both our knowledge and our power in hopes of avoiding the distressing evidence before our own eyes. We are ruining, not running, the world. Modern knowledge has allowed us to manipulate the world, but not to control its fate, to say nothing of our own, a fact that becomes more clear each day as the ecosystem dies and our human systems fail. Indeed, by disconnecting us from the world, objectivism has led us into actions so inharmonious with reality that catastrophe seems inevitable if we stay the course. Objectivism, far from telling the truth about how we know, is a myth meant to feed our fading fantasy of science, technology, power, and control. If we dare to move through our fear, to practice knowing as a form of love, we might abandon our illusion of control and enter a partnership with the otherness of the world. By finding our place in the ecosystem of reality, we might see more clearly which actions are life-giving and which are not, and in the process participate more fully in our own destinies and the destiny of the world than we do in our drive for control. This relational way of knowing, in which love takes away fear and co-creation replaces control, is a way of knowing that can help us reclaim the capacity for connectedness on which good teaching depends. Be not afraid. Fear is everywhere. In our culture, in our institutions, in our students, in ourselves, and it cuts us off from everything. Surrounded and invaded by fear, how can we transcend it and reconnect with reality for the sake of teaching and learning? The only path I know that might take us in that direction is the one marked spiritual. Fear is so fundamental to the human condition that all the great spiritual traditions originate in an effort to overcome its effects on our lives. With different words, they all proclaim the same core message, be not afraid. Though the traditions vary widely in the ways they propose to take us beyond fear, all hold out the same hope. We can escape fear's paralysis and enter a state of grace where encounters with otherness will not threaten us, but will enrich our work and our lives. It is important to note with care what that core teaching does and does not say. Be not afraid does not say that we should not have fears, and if it did, we could dismiss it as an impossible counsel of perfection. Instead, it says that we do not need to be our fears. Quite a different proposition. As a young teacher, I yearned for the day when I would know my craft so well, be so competent, so experienced, and so powerful, that I could walk into any classroom without feeling afraid. But now, in my late 50s, I know that day will never come. I will always have fears. But I need not be my fears, for there are other places in my inner landscape from which I can speak and act. Each time I walk into a classroom, I can choose the place within myself from which my teaching will come, just as I can choose the place within my students toward which my teaching will be aimed. I need not teach from a fearful place. I can teach from curiosity or hope or empathy or honesty, places that are as real within me as are my fears. I can have fear, but I need not be fear, if I am willing to stand someplace else in my inner landscape. We yearn for a different place to stand, and I know of no better description of that yearning than the Rilke poem quoted at the head of the introduction. Ah, not to be cut off, not through the slightest partition shut out from the law of the stars. The inner, what is it, if not intensified sky, hurled through with birds and deep with the winds of homecoming. Cut off is our customary state of being. But there is within us the constant yearning for connectedness, a yearning, to live without the slightest partition between our souls and the distant stars, between ourselves and the world's otherness. We yearn for community with the other because we know that with it we would feel more at home in our lives, no longer strangers to one another and aliens to the earth. But the homecoming of which Rilke speaks has two qualities that make it quite different from our conventional image of home. First, it is inner, not outer. This home is not a place that we can own, but by the same token, we cannot be banned from it, and it cannot be stolen from us. No matter where we are or what condition we are in or how many obstacles are before us, we can always come back home through a simple inward turning. Second, when we make that inward turn, the home we find is not a closed and parochial place in which we can hide, from which we can neither see nor be seen. Instead, this home is as open and vast as the sky itself. Here we are at home with more than our own familiar thoughts and those people who think like us. We are at home in a universe that embraces both the smallness of I and the vastness of all that is not I, and does so with consummate ease. In this home, we know ourselves not as isolated atoms threatened by otherness, but as integral parts of the great web of life. In that knowing, we are taken beyond fear toward wholeness. In response to the question, how can we move beyond the fear that destroys connectedness, I am saying, by reclaiming the connectedness that takes away fear. I realize the circularity of my case, but that is precisely how the spiritual life moves, in circles that have no beginning or end, where, as Eliot writes, we arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. The only question is whether we choose to stand outside of the circle or within it. How do we get into that circle? When we are gripped by the fears that keep us disconnected, what will move us toward joining hands with others? The truth is that the circle is already in us. In the human psyche, apparent opposites chase each other around in circles all the time. Love and hate, laughter and tears, fear and desire. Our intense fear of connectedness and the challenges it brings is pursued by an equally intense desire for connectedness and the comforts it offers. For all the fearful efforts we make to protect ourselves by disconnecting, the human soul yearns eternally for connection. Ah, not to be cut off. We can get into the circle that is already within us by abandoning ourselves to the yearnings that run just behind or ahead of our fears. Sometimes all it takes is a simple step. In a group of experienced K-12 teachers I worked with for 2 years was a high school shop teacher, 6 feet 6 inches tall, weighing 240 pounds, athletic and deep of voice. No one ever thought of this man as afraid, not even the man himself. For several years, the principal at his school had been pressing the teacher to attend a summer institute on technology. The shop curriculum, said the principal, had to be modernized, and quickly, or the students would be lost in the past. Nonsense, this fearless teacher replied. The technology touted at that institute is probably just a fad. Even if it isn't, high school students need to learn the basics, hands-on work with materials and tools. There will be plenty of time later on for fancy refinements of their technique. The shop teacher and his principal became locked in a demoralizing cycle of demands and refusals, each exacerbating the other. Their relations grew adversarial and strained. As the shop teacher participated in our group, that brokenness weighed heavy on his heart. Then one day, the shop teacher came to a meeting and told us that the cycle had been broken. His principal had called him in to make his demands once more. This time, instead of arguing the merits of the traditional shop curriculum, the teacher looked at his principal and said, "I still don't want to go to that institute, but now I know why. I'm afraid. Afraid I won't understand it. Afraid my field has passed me by. Afraid I am a has-been as a teacher." There was a long silence, and then the principal spoke. "I'm afraid, too," he said. "Let's go to the institute together." They did, and they reclaimed and deepened their friendship, and the shop teacher feels he is making progress toward modernizing the curriculum and revitalizing his vocation. This teacher's breakthrough did not directly involve adopting a new technique for teaching. Indeed, it did not directly involve doing anything at all. His breakthrough was into a new way of being, into the realization that he could have fear but did not need to be fear, that he could speak and act from a place of honesty about being fearful rather than from the fear itself. The shop teacher honored a yearning within himself that was just behind or ahead of his fear, the yearning not to be cut off from his principal, his students, his world of work, or his teacher's heart. Sometimes the way beyond fear is just that simple. Chapter 3. The Hidden Wholeness. Paradox in Teaching and Learning. There is in all visible things an invisible fecundity, a dimmed light, a meek namelessness, a hidden wholeness. This mysterious unity and integrity is wisdom, the mother of all. Natura Naturans. Thomas Merton, Hagia Sophia. Thinking the World Together. The culture of disconnection that undermines teaching and learning is driven partly by fear. But it is also driven by our Western commitment to thinking in polarities, a thought form that elevates disconnection into an intellectual virtue. This way of thinking is so embedded in our culture that we rarely escape it, even when we try. And my own words will prove the point. In earlier chapters, I tried to correct several imbalances in the way we approach teaching. To correct our overemphasis on technique, I stressed the teacher's identity and integrity. To correct our obsession with objective knowledge, I stressed subjective engagement. To correct our excessive regard for the powers of intellect, I stressed the power of emotions to freeze or free the mind. My intent was to rebalance the scales. But in a polarizing culture, it is hard to do that without slamming the scales in the opposite direction. In arguing for the neglected pole, I may be mistaken for someone who excuses poor technique, urging teachers just to be themselves, who believes there are no standards for truth, just whatever you think it is, who doesn't care about the content of your thoughts just as long as you share what you feel. It is obvious, I hope, that these are distortions of what I have said. But we distort things this way all the time because we are trained neither to voice both sides of an issue nor to listen with both ears. The problem goes deeper than the bad habit of competitive conversation some of us have. Tell me your thesis, and I will find any way, fair or foul, to argue the other side. It is rooted in the fact that we look at the world through analytical lenses. We see everything as this or that, plus or minus, on or off, black or white. And we fragment reality into an endless series of either-ors. In a phrase, we think the world apart. Thinking the world apart, like thinking at a distance, has given us great power. Just as I respect the power of objectivity, rightly understood, I respect the power of analysis in its rightful place. I have used analytical tools to develop my thesis in this book, and the remarkable machine on which I am writing it is driven by millions upon millions of either-or decisions. Without binary logic, we would have neither computers nor many of the gifts of modern science. But for all the power it has given us in science and technology, either-or thinking has also given us a fragmented sense of reality that destroys the wholeness and wonder of life. Our problem is compounded by the fact that this mode of knowing has become normative in nearly every area, even though it misleads and betrays us when applied to the perennial problems of being human that lie beyond the reach of logic. How can we escape the grip of either-or thinking? What would it look like to think the world together, not to abandon discriminatory logic where it serves us well, but to develop a more capacious habit of mind that supports the capacity for connectedness on which good teaching depends? Niels Bohr, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist, offers the keystone I want to build on. The opposite of a true statement is a false statement, but the opposite of a profound truth can be another profound truth. With a few well-chosen words, Bohr defines a concept that is essential to thinking the world together, the concept of paradox. In certain circumstances, truth is found not by splitting the world into either-ors, but by embracing it as both-and. In certain circumstances, truth is a paradoxical joining of apparent opposites, and if we want to know that truth, we must learn to embrace those opposites as one. In the empirical world, as Bohr makes clear, there are choices to be made between true and false, choices that must be informed by fact and reason. If the question before us is whether a particular tree is an oak or a maple, we can examine its pedigree in full confidence that it cannot be both, and that certain empirical markers will reveal what kind it is. But Bohr also affirms another realm of knowing, where binary logic misleads us. This is the realm of profound truth, where, if we want to know what is essential, we must stop thinking the world into pieces and start thinking it together again. Profound truth, rather than empirical fact, is the stuff of which paradoxes are made. But profound need not mean exotic or esoteric. We encounter paradoxical profundities every day simply because we are human, for we ourselves are paradoxes that breathe. Indeed, breathing itself is a form of paradox, requiring inhaling and exhaling to be whole. The first two chapters of this book are full of ordinary truths about teaching that can be expressed only as paradoxes. The knowledge I have gained from 30 years of teaching goes hand in hand with my sense of being a rank amateur at the start of each new class. My inward and invisible sense of identity becomes known even to me only as it manifests itself in encounters with external and visible otherness. Good teaching comes from identity, not technique. But if I allow my identity to guide me toward an integral technique, that technique can help me express my identity more fully. Teaching always takes place at the crossroads of the personal and the public. And if I want to teach well, I must learn to stand where these opposites intersect. Intellect works in concert with feeling, so if I hope to open my students' minds, I must open their emotions as well. None of these truths about teaching can be approached as a simple either-or, though in academic culture we constantly try to do so. When I speak with faculty about the fear students bring into the classroom and how it paralyzes their ability to learn, often some critic will say, "So you want us to stop being professors and become therapists?" No. That is not what I want. What I want is a richer, more paradoxical model of teaching and learning than binary thought allows. A model that reveals how the paradox of thinking and feeling are joined, whether we are comfortable with paradox or not. Behind the critic's comment is a trained incapacity to see that heart and mind work as one in our students and in ourselves. They cannot be treated separately, one by the professor, the other by the therapist. When a person is healthy and whole, the head and the heart are both and, not either or. And teaching that honors that paradox can help make us all more whole. When things fall apart. It takes training to think the world apart, because we arrive in this world with an instinctive capacity to hold paradoxes together. Watch a young child go through the day, and you will see how action and rest, thought and feeling, tears and laughter are intimate and inseparable companions. In a child, the opposites commingle and co-create each other with the animal fluidity of breathing in and out. But that easy embrace of paradox is soon drummed out of us. Early in our journey toward adulthood, we are taught that survival depends on our ability to dissect life and discriminate among its parts. The ability to discriminate is important, but only where the failure to do so will get us into trouble. A child must learn the difference between hot and cold to keep from getting hurt, and the difference between right and wrong to keep from hurting others. But it is equally important that we retain, or recover, the ability to embrace paradox where discrimination will get us into trouble. The kind of trouble we get into when we enter adulthood with partitions between thinking and feeling, personal and professional, shadow and light. We split paradoxes so reflexively that we do not understand the price we pay for our habit. The poles of a paradox are like the poles of a battery. Hold them together and they generate the energy of life. Pull them apart and the current stops flowing. When we separate any of the profound paired truths of our lives, both poles become lifeless specters of themselves, and we become lifeless as well. Dissecting a living paradox has the same impact on our intellectual, emotional, and spiritual well-being as the decision to breathe in without ever breathing out would have on our physical health. Consider our paradoxical need for both community and solitude. Human beings were made for relationships. Without a rich and nourishing network of connections, we wither and die. I am not speaking metaphorically. It is a clinical fact that people who lack relationships get sick more often and recover more slowly than people surrounded by family and friends. At the same time, we were made for solitude. Our lives may be rich in relationships, but the human self remains a mystery of enfolded inwardness that no other person can possibly enter or know. If we fail to embrace our ultimate aloneness and seek meaning only in communion with others, we wither and die. Other-directedness may serve us well in certain roles or at certain stages of life, but the farther we travel toward the great mystery, the more at home we must be with our essential aloneness in order to stay healthy and whole. Our equal and opposite needs for solitude and community constitute a great paradox. When it is torn apart, both of these life-giving states of being degenerate into deathly specters of themselves. Solitude split off from community is no longer a rich and fulfilling experience of inwardness. Now it becomes loneliness, a terrible isolation. Community split off from solitude is no longer a nurturing network of relationships. Now it becomes a crowd, an alienating buzz of too many people and too much noise. As Dietrich Bonhoeffer said, "Let the person who cannot be alone beware of community. Let the person who is not in community beware of being alone." In a culture that rips paradoxes apart, many people know nothing of the rich dialectic of solitude and community. They know only a daily whiplash between loneliness and the crowd. We even have personality technologies to make the whiplash stronger. I am thinking of the psychological tests we use or misuse to categorize ourselves as personality types. Am I introverted or extroverted, inner-directed or other-directed, intuitive or sensate, feminine and made for community, or masculine and made for competition? we put ourselves in either-or boxes or are put there by others, and fail to embrace the paradoxical nature of the human self. The world of education as we know it is filled with broken paradoxes and with the lifeless results. We separate head from heart. Result, minds that do not know how to feel and hearts that do not know how to think. We separate facts from feelings. Result, bloodless facts that make the world distant and remote, and ignorant